Chapter 12. There is, for some reason, something especially grim about pubs near stations. A very particular kind of grubbiness, a special kind of pallor to the pork pies. Worse than the pork pies, though, are the sandwiches. There is a feeling which persists in England that making a sandwich interesting, attractive, or in any way pleasant to eat is something sinful that only foreigners do. Make 'em dry is the instruction buried somewhere in the collective national consciousness. Make 'em rubbery. If you have to keep the buggers fresh, do it by washing them once a week. It is by eating sandwiches in pubs on Saturday lunchtimes that the British seek to atone for whatever their national sins have been. They're not altogether clear what those sins are, and don't want to know either. Sins are not the sort of things one wants to know about, but whatever sins there are amply atoned for by the sandwiches they make themselves eat. If there is anything worse than the sandwiches, it is the sausages which sit next to them. Joyless tubes full of gristle, floating in a sea of something hot and sad, stuck with a plastic pin in the shape of a chef's hat. A memorial, one feels, for some chef who hated the world and died forgotten and alone among his cats in a back stair in Stepney. The sausages are for the ones who know what their sins are and wish to atone for something specific. "There must be somewhere better," said Arthur. "No time," said Fanny, glancing at her watch. "My train leaves in half an hour." They sat at a small wobbly table. On it were some dirty glasses and some soggy beer mats with jokes printed on them. Arthur got Fanny a tomato juice and himself a pint of yellow water with gas in it, and a couple of sausages. He didn't know why. He bought them for something to do while the gas settled in his glass. The barman dunked Arthur's change in a pool of beer on the bar, for which Arthur thanked him. "All right," said Fanny, glancing at her watch. "Tell me what it is you have to tell me." She sounded, as well she might, extremely sceptical, and Arthur's heart sank. Hardly, he felt, the most conducive setting to try to explain to her, as she sat there, suddenly cool and defensive, that in a sort of out-of-body dream he had had a telepathic sense that the mental breakdown she had suffered had been connected with the fact that, appearances to the contrary notwithstanding, the Earth had been demolished to make way for a new hyperspace bypass, something which he alone on Earth knew anything about, having virtually witnessed it from a Vogon spaceship, and that furthermore both his body and soul ached for her unbearably, and he needed to go to bed with her as soon as was humanly possible. "Fenny," he started. "I wonder if you'd like to buy some tickets for our raffle. It's just a little one." He glanced up sharply. "To raise money for Angie, who's retiring."
"What?"
"And needs a kidney machine." He was being leant over by a rather stiffly slim, middle-aged woman with a prim knitted suit, a prim little perm, and a prim little smile that probably got licked by prim little dogs a lot. She was holding out a small book of cloakroom tickets and a collecting tin.
"Only 10 pence each," she said, "so you could probably even buy two, without breaking the bank."
She gave a tinkly little laugh, and then a curiously long sigh. Saying, "without breaking the bank," had obviously given her more pleasure than anything since some GIs had been billeted on her during the war. "Yes, all right," said Arthur, hurriedly digging in his pocket and producing a couple of coins. With infuriating slowness and prim theatricality, there was such a thing, the woman tore off two tickets and handed them to Arthur. "I do hope you win," she said with a smile that suddenly snapped together like a piece of advanced origami. "The prizes are so nice." Yes, thank you," said Arthur, pocketing the tickets rather brusquely and glancing at his watch. He turned towards Fanny. So did the woman with the raffle tickets.
"And what about you, young lady?" she said. "It's for Angie's kidney machine. She's retiring, you see."
"Yes." She hoisted the little smile even further up her face. She would have to stop and let it go soon, or the skin would surely split.
"Look, here you are," said Arthur, and pushed a 50-pence piece at her in the hope that that would see her off.
"Oh, we are in the money, aren't we?" said the woman, with a long, smiling sigh. "Down from London, are we?"
Arthur wished she wouldn't talk so bloody slowly. "No, that's all right, really," he said, with a wave of his hand, as she started with awful deliberation to peel off 5 tickets, one by one.
"Oh, but you must have our tickets," insisted the woman, "or you won't be able to claim your prize. They're very nice prizes, you know, very suitable."
Arthur snatched the tickets and said thank you as sharply as he could. The woman turned to Fanny once again.
"And now what about—"
"No!" Arthur nearly yelled. "These are for her," he explained, brandishing the 5 new tickets.
"Oh, I see. How nice."
She smiled sickeningly at both of them.
"Well, I do hope."
"Yes," snapped Arthur, "thank you." The woman finally departed to the table next to theirs. Arthur turned desperately to Fenny and was relieved to see that she was rocking with silent laughter. He smiled and sighed. "Where were we?" he said.
"You were calling me Fenny, and I was about to ask you not to."
"What do you mean?" She twirled the little wooden cocktail stick in her tomato juice. "It's why I asked if you were a friend of my brother's, or half-brother, really. He's the only one who calls me Fenny, and I'm not fond of him for it."